Members, the chair calls the Committee on Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Division to order. Today's agenda is really quite simple, but hopefully chock full of lots of good information. We'll walk through the budget requests of the Department of Public Safety, and we're going to include the Pulse Board budget request, as well as the sentencing guidelines request as well. We'll be rounding out the budget requests, I believe, next week, Tuesday evening for corrections. Next week, members will be a bit busy. We're basically, the chair wants to have us focus on youth and public safety. And so we're going to hear from a number of folks that we've, some we've heard before, some that we haven't, and hopefully just center ourselves on juvenile justice, youth empowerment, ways in which this division and our work in corrections and public safety supports young people. I think we've got, I think we have two evening hearings. Okay, very good. So we're going to have two evening hearings on Tuesday and Wednesday. We're going to avoid doing one on Thursday. And of course, Thursday, as you all know, will be, I think right now we're scheduled to have the region selection on the floor. So that'll eat up some time. And quite frankly, I prefer that we not meet on Thursday evenings. And I'm sure a number of you have long distances to travel, you know, would support that. We're also going to be hearing on Wednesday, House File 8 and 9?
Yes.
House File 8 and 9 in the evening. And we are confirmed?
Yes.
So so this will be a field hearing out in Edina, at the Edina High School. And then,
middle school.
Oh, is it the middle school now?
Yes.
Okay. Edina Middle School. House File 8 and 9 are Representative Pintle's bills dealing with firearms. So with that, members, I'm going to Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the information you did give. Just wondering when at least our staff and our members would have an idea of what bills we're going to be hearing next week so we can prepare for them. And I thank you for giving the notice of House Files 8 and 9, because those are very, by my emails, very hot topic.
Yes.
And it's on both sides of the aisle. But I'm disappointed that we're going down to Edina. Some of our members drive home every day. For me, that's another half-hour drive for me to get home. I don't stay down here. I go home to my family every night. And that's rather burdensome to me and to a couple other of my members that actually have to drive. So I wish you'd reconsider that. This is where we do our legislation. I believe this is if the Capitol is where we should be talking about this.
Representative Johnson, that's certainly fair. We do occasionally have meetings out in the greater public, and this particular community has opened itself up for that. There is a strong interest given, quite frankly, the tragic events of the last year or two involving firearms and our schools, that we thought it was really important that we have that kind of discussion in that setting so that we can maximize the ability of people from the schools communities to participate. We are going to provide transportation. So you'll be from here, a round trip, so you'll be getting that information shortly. And trying to think what else I wanted to add to that. I think that's it. So with that, Representative Nash.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I would echo what Representative Johnson said. You know, one of the things, Mr. Chair, is the security of this building is known, and our sergeants do a very good job of controlling this building and all that come in and out. I don't know what you have intended for this middle school, but I can guarantee you that Sergeant Meyerson will have done a better job here than whatever you've arranged for over there, and I would urge you to reconsider and have the hearings here in the state capitol, where people elect us to come and do the people's work. This is the place where that is done. So, Mr. Chair, I would urge you to really reconsider that.
Representative Ash, I will certainly take your advice under consideration. I've served here for a couple of decades, and having official hearings out in the public among Minnesotans is not a novel idea. And quite frankly, my experience has been that it's been an enriching idea, an empowering idea for the public as well as for legislators. Chair Considine held a hearing just a couple of weeks ago in a corrections facility at Stillwater. I think everyone who participated would probably say that that was an enriching experience. It's different when you have a feel as you deliberate, being out in the public, as well as the public having access to you. My hope, quite frankly, is that this legislature would do that more often. There are lots of folks who have a hard time getting to St. Paul, getting to the Capitol, and yet they have no less of an interest in participating in our democratic process. And to the extent that we can encourage that, I would hope that we are all supportive of that.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, very well.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to reiterate and to ask you a question, are you saying that this is not a public building? This is not where we encourage people to come and engage with their legislators? I have hundreds of meetings here, and I've presented firearms bills in this building, and we've been always very accommodating to the public. And again, I just want to reiterate that the access and control is managed by Sergeant Meyerson very, very well. Our Sergeant-at-Arms is exceptionally professional. This is the venue that he and his staff manage and maintain. And you dropped this on us very last minute. I don't believe that this is going to be something that it will be as securable or manageable as would a middle school. So again, I would urge you to conduct business in the people's house.
Representative Nash, you are certainly entitled to your opinion, even as I disagree with it.
Thank you for that.
This hearing we have always posted our hearings with due time in order to make sure the public participates. I don't think what you're saying is that it's not important for the public to be able to have access to our deliberation, whether it's here or out among them in the community. I would certainly hope that's not your belief. Representative Johnson, I'm going to call on you, but let me say this. If we don't get through this budget hearing today, we're going to be back here tonight. So we can talk about this for as long as you want, but we will be back here to finish this budget hearing. Representative Johnson.
Just two quick things. One, is I do have a lot of concern going out there. Like I say, not just for myself, but it's because of the distance I have to drive. But also the fact people know where the state capitol is. People in my district know where the state capitol is. People in across the state know where the state capitol is. Now you're telling the people that live north of here they have to drive farther. They have a lot of passion, and not instead of during the day, they're doing it in the evening. During the last session, when we had some of these bills come forward, we had people from way up north, up by International Falls, Baudette. They all came down to the Capitol because of these hearings. They were during the daytime. Now you're doing them at night. My guess is I'm not sure what time we're going to start. Well, we'll be probably going till 10, 11 at night. And these people are going to be driving back all the way up to International Falls, a 6 to 8 hour drive. I think that is disrespectful for the people in my congressional, not just my district, but my congressional district. And so I have a lot of concerns about that. I also am wondering how will the seating for proponents and opponents of these bills take place? Have you discussed that with the Sergeant of Arms office?
Representative Johnson, we have made all the normal, typical arrangements for a public hearing, whether the hearing is going to be held here or anywhere else. The glass can certainly be half-empty, but I'll tell you, if you live out in the southwestern corner of the metro area, it's probably half-full. And the point is that this will be a public, transparent meeting. We plan to convene at 5. My goal is to be done by 8 o'clock. Hopefully that'll get you back here with the transportation that we've provided so that you can get home at a good time. I frankly, members, I don't know what else to tell you. I'm giving you good notice ahead of time in a process that looks to maximize our ability to have the public participate in this conversation. And I guess we're entitled to our own opinions about that, but, you know, the chair's decision certainly stands that we're going to have this meeting on Tuesday out at the Edina Middle School. Representative Johnson.
One last thing. We worked very hard to get this committee meeting in the public's eye, televised, so the public can see it and watch this, because this is one of the most watched committees. Are you going to be able to make arrangements so that committee meeting will be televised to the public in live time?
Representative Johnson, you and I can certainly work together to make that happen. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a technical scheduling question. We've gotten a lot of emails about corrections meeting at times that we don't normally meet and then reconvening. And maybe this is incorrect on my calendar, but I have that the corrections committee, of which several of us here are on that committee as well, reconvening at 5 o'clock in this room. And so I'm just confused. And maybe that's on my calendar incorrectly. We've had a lot of emails back and forth. Can you just clarify the schedule for both public safety and corrections just so that I know where I'm going and when to show up at the right place?
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for an opportunity to be clear about that. So this will be a joint hearing of both that committee and that subcommittee of this committee. A number of us serve on that committee, but some don't. But it will be a joint hearing. Oh, the DLC budget presentation. Very well. And so that makes sense then, that as opposed to having the corrections do two presentations, budget presentations, that they do it to the joint gathering of both these committees.
So, Mr. Chair, just for clarification's sake, can you just tell me again, we're going to be meeting here in this room during our regular time on Tuesday and Wednesday or not? And when is it that we do go to Edina?
Oh, so very well. Okay. Representative O'Neill, I'm sorry. I thought we were talking about Wednesday evening. We're talking about the Tuesday evening. You had asked a question about corrections meeting on Tuesday evening. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would love to know what the whole schedule is, because I'm just confused. I'm not sure when we're meeting together, when we're meeting off-site, when we're meeting here. Maybe you could just clarify the whole schedule.
Representative O'Neill, we'll send notice out to clarify. I hope that the notice that you got about Tuesday made it clear that that was a joint corrections and public safety criminal justice reform committee hearing, but we will clarify that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It wasn't clear on my schedule, and maybe the email was more clear. It just says reconvene for corrections. So, and maybe I could ask, are we having an extra meeting then for corrections on Tuesday morning?
Yes, we are, Representative O'Leary.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just make a note that our time here is really, really valuable, and I hope that we can move forward with these presentations. I've done a little bit of research, and not to question Representative Johnson's, but it seems the distance from the Capitol to Cambridge is 55 minutes, and the distance from Edina to Cambridge is an hour and 2 minutes, so it's a 7-minute difference. And whether you live farther out, it's still sort of, it's not significant. And Representative Nash, I and members, I get lost in the irony that your concern is about security at Edina High School when we're going to be bringing up issues around gun safety. So I just want to point that out, that while we're going to be talking about issues of guns and safety, your primary concern is the issue of safety. So that's all.
Representative Gosnard and then our members, I want us to get to the agenda that we posted here for today. My hope is that we can honor the department's presence so they can get through their budget request for us and that we don't drag them back here in the evening to complete it. Representative Gosnard.
That's actually my point. We've been here now 25 minutes. That's the reason we're having these evening meetings, is these protracted discussions about things. And if we could get back on track, I'd appreciate it.
Very well. Commissioner Harrington, welcome to the committee. We look forward to your presentation of the governor's budget request.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. It's good to be back. I think it seems like I just left. Today I'm presenting the budget for One Minnesota for the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety has about 12 different departments, six of which are, generally speaking, public safety committee-related departments. Those include the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement, also known as the Fun Police, the Fire Marshal Division, the Office of Justice Programs, which does most of our victim service work, the Emergency Communications Network, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Yeah. Department of Budget is a, out of this committee, total budget for the Department of Public Safety is about $789 million. The Public Safety Division of this is $367 million, of which $205 million comes from the general fund, $135 million comes from state gov special revenue. We have a little money coming out of state highway trunk funds, and then another $30 million coming out of a different special revenue account. The way we spend the money is we divide that up into fours. $107 million of that comes, what we call, goes to operating costs. That essentially is facilities. Driver's license stations, well, different committee, sorry. BCA headquarters, pipeline security, those emergency management facilities, and then a big number on that is also our IT ask there. So the biggest number is the salary component, and beyond that we do local assistance, which is grants to local agencies, county, state, and other, and then transfers also. Starting out at the top, the emergency communications network. ECN receives no funding from the general fund, but collects about 95 cents on a monthly fee assessed from all wired, wireless, prepaid, wired, and packet-based telecommunication service by accessing, that all will access 911 in Minnesota. We receive an annual appropriation of about $77 million from the 911 emergency services account, we are not looking for any additional funding for the ECN this year. The area where we have needed additional funding is in our technology needs, and we have essentially been told by Minute that the way that the Department of Public Safety had budgeted for IT over the years is an inefficient and an ineffective way of budgeting. Essentially, what I have learned since being here is that the Department of Public Safety would buy our computers when we, at the end of the biennium, with whatever leftover money there was, which meant that we were under a crunch to buy them rather rapidly because we're going to run out of money, and we were not buying them in a timely fashion. As a consequence, there'd be a large load of computers that would come in. They oftentimes were not necessarily the best and the brightest, and in many cases, they needed different maintenance standards to keep all of these different disparate types of equipment. What Minute has suggested, and what is now becoming best practices in the industry, is that you buy the computers throughout the lifespan, and that you, as you're buying them, you buy them with the understanding that you have to have both updates, maintenance, and upkeep on them. And so that has increased our IT budget. Our core technology services, we're asking for $1.53 million from the general fund, $190 from special revenue, and $395 from the 911 emergency fund. This will supplement a budget of about $30 million that's in there already for IT services.
Commissioner, I'm going to interrupt. We have a question from Representative Johnson. And members, I do want to encourage you, so a heads up to you and the others, that I think the best way to have this conversation is, in fact, for members to ask the questions as we go along and not wait to the end because of the details that are involved here. So with that, Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I'm glad you invited the people to, or the members to ask questions as we go along, because we did not, we're not provided PowerPoint copies of the PowerPoints to take notes on as we go along.
Representative Johnson, I believe you should have those in your packet. Okay, so we got these from the department a little bit later after we were stuffing the packets, for sure. But okay. Let's, Representative Johnson, we'll make sure the staff can copy those and pass those out. And in the meantime,
I would
encourage you to use the screens. It looks like some of us have them. I have one.
Mr. Chair, I believe we tried to hand them out before the committee began. Are any of the committee members lacking a copy? We'll make sure they get them right away.
If you don't have a copy, please let the page know, and we'll get you one. It looks like a number of us do have it. But in the meantime, Representative Johnson, you have a question, I believe.
I do have a question with what the Commissioner Harrington was talking about. It's an issue that I've wondered about for quite a while, and he sort of brought it to light. We have a lot of agencies that should be budgeting these things in their budget, these computers and technology, and it should be in their budget. Should be in the capital outlay for equipment, which we never have in a capital outlay line anymore, in any of our state departments and state budgets. But what caught my attention was his last line. At the end of the year, with any money left over that may not have been needed, they're buying stuff to use up their budget. Is that the right thing to do, or is that just making Minnesota more expensive?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I would rather reframe that to say it's not a matter of if there's any extra money. What we did was we would expend all the money on the essentials, and if there was any money left over, we would then reprioritize that money to make sure that we were buying computers and buying other essentials that we had not been budgeted for prior to that. And so this was a matter of a budgetary strategy that says we know that we have to provide training. We know we have to provide facilities. We know we have to pay salaries. But occasionally there are salary savings because someone leaves the service and you have some dollars left over. When that happens, since there wasn't a budgetary item for buying computers or buying other essential equipment, we would then use that dollars to try and catch up with that. So it isn't a matter that we had money that was just left laying around. It was a matter of trying to use all the dollars that were available to us to make sure that we use those dollars on an appropriate public safety need.
Very well, Commissioner. Please proceed.
Alcohol and gambling. The Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement receives an annual appropriation of $2.74 million. It collects $1.24 million per year in special revenue, of which $500,000 in receipts are transferred to the general fund each year. The Gambling Control Board also transfers about $70,000 to the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement team every year. Our 2019 budget policy request really speaks to the issue around micro distilleries. And we are going to need some additional latitude to try and regulate those new operations as they come online. What we're seeing is that much as we're seeing with the fire safety service, where we're seeing barns now certainly converted to wedding facilities that don't have emergency procedures, they don't have fire escapes and things along that lines. The micro distilleries also are going to require some regulation. They're coming online much faster than anyone expected, and so we're going to need to be able to use some of the money for that purpose in addition. So special revenue monies, are, as I said, are also derived from the state tribal compacts. These are primarily from fingerprint fees, and then we also get some from the 2 a.m. licensing Final Four is coming up. There'll be a 4 a.m. license, and that'll also require us to do some additional work there. Our budget supports 21 FTEs, that's 6 licensing staff, 6 liquor investigators, 7 special agents, and a director who oversees the projects.
Commissioner, we have a question from Charity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. So you mentioned all the new micro distilleries and stuff. Don't we, like, assess them fees to cover their sort of enforcement around their particular, you know, the industry? I mean, I would hope that we are charging, whether it's micro distilleries, whether it's, you know, craft brewers, that somehow in the process they actually pay for the supervision and then enforcement. So if you could just sort of explain that to me, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, this does not have a fiscal note, so you are in fact absolutely correct that in fact the fees that are paid do cover the expense, but the statute doesn't speak to the micro distilleries, and all we're asking is a policy change here that will bring micro distilleries in with other alcohol-producing organizations. So it is a policy change, not a fiscal change at all.
Thank you, Chair. Please continue, Commissioner.
State Fire Marshal is the next agency. State Fire Marshal receives an annual appropriation of $6.42 million in special revenue funds. Here in 2019, we have a budget policy request that once again has no fiscal impact. The budget request is to allow us to use the cigarette ignition propensity account, which I cannot say three times fast, and expand its uses so that we can use it for educational materials, to redirect toward reducing fire deaths from smoking materials, and also target younger adults entering post-secondary education with better information and better education about the effect of cigarette smoking as a fire hazard, as separate from a general health hazard. Fire numbers this last year, one of the things that was a surprise to me, old cop, not much on the fire side, so I'm learning every day there. But fire safety violations cited, there were over 9,000 fire safety violations cited last year. Arson investigations, there were 561 arson investigations, and the number that really struck me was 36 fire fatalities. You know, I think we talk about crashes and fatalities on the highway. We talk about domestic violence and domestic homicides there. But 36 Minnesotans who lost their life to fire is no number that we should ignore, and we need to continue to work diligently to try and reduce that number even more.
Commissioner, I take it those are primarily residential fires in which this is happening? Every once in a while, I'll read a story of a tragic incident in a multiplex unit somewhere.
Mr. Chair, yes, 25 of the 36 were residential fires, fire fatalities. But clearly some of the bigger arsons that you've seen lately have been large commercial structural fires also. And so those are also investigated to see if they are of natural consequences or an accident, or in some cases if they were deliberately set. And those are incredibly complicated, complex investigations that require both basic police science of investigation, interview, and interrogation to be mixed with forensic science, and then also to be mixed with an extensive knowledge of engineering to make sure that it's not a wiring issue or it's not a gas leak that causes the fire, so that we have to rule out all of the natural possibilities and then start turning our attention to when all of the natural possibilities have been eliminated, then we have to turn to why did this happen, because there's always a cause. It's just a matter of digging deep enough to find it.
Commissioner, we do have a question. Representative Johnson.
I just didn't make more of a comment. It's unfortunate the number of fire deaths that we've had, but I know at least in my area and talking to a number of firefighters across the state, especially in greater Minnesota, we have a fantastic group of volunteer firefighters. And they're all saying they're doing a great job of fire education, going to the schools, talking to people, having community events. And across the board, I believe the number of fires are actually down.
Very well. Commissioner, do you have any insight on that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, I do not know whether the total number of fires are down or if that's a regional number. The conversations I've had with both the professional firefighters and the volunteer firefighters and the fire chiefs did give me pause that the number of fire fatalities was still a great concern to them. Whether the actual number of fires, whether they are car fires and other fires, are down or not, I certainly will get some information and get back to you on that, but I don't have that number off the top of my head.
Really appreciate that. Please continue, Commissioner.
Office of Justice Programs, OJP, Director Katie Weeks is here. I know that you have not had a chance to have an overview of her budget as of yet, but we'll hopefully be able to provide that. Office of Justice Program is one of those places that I was most familiar with because it serves victims directly. The Crime Victim Reparations Board is there, Crime Victims Justice Unit, which back in my day was the Crime Victims Ombudsman's Unit, Grant Management that works to make sure that we have nonprofits and social service agencies that are helping with abused children, battered women, domestic violence, sexual assault, and then general crime victims all come out of the Office of Justice Program. We also, in addition to victim services, also provide justice and community grants that reduce crime, work on issues around juvenile delinquency, work on issues around drug abuse, and then general violence intervention and prevention. And we do provide a victim resource center in terms of statistical analysis of that. The Office of Justice Program has an annual appropriation from the general fund of $39.9 million. And as I said, one of the things that I'm most proud of with that organization is it is administering state and federal grants to over 750 nonprofits and local units of government. So we're getting the money that we bring in and we're pushing it out to one Minnesota to make sure that it is shared by all where the need is greatest. And I think one of the responsibilities of government, and in particular, is that we are the group that represents the victims. There are private folks that will represent the suspects in cases, but there is nobody else out there other than government, I think, and these nonprofits that will stand up and say, we are here to tell you the story of the victim and to try and make that victim whole again. So the state investment provides these grants, and our 2019 request is primarily related to the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women's Task Force. That is in the governor's budget. I will tell you, when I joined Transit in 2012. The first community meeting I was invited to was by the Little Earth Tribe. Little Earth Tribe stopped me, and the Women's Indian Consortium invited me there because they were having women solicited for prostitution. They were having women who were being battered and beaten literally on the train tracks as they were waiting for train service in that neighborhood, and they wanted to know what Transit was going to do about it. That is a microcosm of a much bigger problem, and I believe that this task force, which will be convened in consultation with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, that will advise you and the governor on both the causes and the extent of the problem, because right now, I will tell you, when we talked to the young women at the Little Earth Tribe, what they said is, well, first of all, they didn't think anybody was going to believe them, and secondly, they didn't think anybody was going to do anything about it, even if they did believe them. That's a horrible statement about the state of government, but it is, in fact, a reality for young women who are living in a marginalized world. And that is aside from, I think, the general marginalization that women who are victims of sexual and domestic violence often experience. So we are asking for $105,000 in 2020 and $45,000 in 2021 for this task force.
Commissioner, so is that the, and perhaps you haven't finished, but is that the extent of the Office of Justice Program's new asks, or what is the overall?
There is no physical impact other than this one task force which we're asking to create and to staff. But if you wanted to give us more money, I personally would not be offended by that at all. I would be happy to have a conversation. As you know, I have been working on domestic violence and domestic homicide for a number of years, and would love to have a conversation about what we could do statewide to reduce the frequency of domestic violence and, in particular, reduce the frequency of domestic homicide.
Commissioner, I think we will be having a conversation in the coming weeks. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. So one of the things that we've already looked at here is a working group for criminal sexual conduct rewrite with the Department of Public Safety, hopefully heading that up. So just wanted to highlight that as an additional ask that we have here. Thank you.
Chair, Representative Moeller. Not Miller, Moeller, I get that now. So we appreciate that, and I know the BCA is involved in that, and Office of Justice Programs are also involved in that, and I look forward to being involved in and that whole issue of justice that's been denied is really one that I take very personally, having run police departments that have had to look themselves in the eye and say, have we done the right thing by victims of criminal sexual conduct? So,
thank you.
Commissioner, I appreciate the value that you've stated. I just do want to correct Representative Moeller, however. The legislature doesn't ask the executive branch for appropriations. We actually give them.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's the executive branch that asks us for appropriations. Very well, Commissioner.
Thank you very much. So, moving on to Homeland Security.
Commissioner.
Moving on to Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Homeland Security receives an annual appropriation from the general fund of $2.6 million, which is about 23% of their operating budget. They administer the federal Homeland Security Emergency Management and Disaster Recovery Grants to local units of government. As we mentioned, as we were looking at deficiency earlier, we've seen the script on disasters flip, whereas in the past it used to be the federal government was the primary payer, but as the rules of engagement have changed and now the standard for federal disaster recovery money is at $10 million and we're everything underneath, we are seeing more and more often that Department of Homeland Security is being asked to come in and support local disaster or state disaster declarations in that $2.5, $2.8 million range there. So we administer that money. We also administer federal Homeland Security and Emergency Management Disaster Recovery Grants. We have 11 state hazmat response teams, and they receive an annual base appropriation of $850,000 from the fire safety account. So we manage the disaster assistance contingency account. And we have a deficient funding request of $10 million for 2019. When I arrived, we had $600,000 in the disaster account, which means that what normally happens is we have a match that we have to do even to just match the FEMA amount to access the federal government amount. That would have been for the Duluth disaster, for example, about $2.5 million. So we were $1.9 million. Short of being able to match even that one disaster. And frankly, given the rate of floods, tornadoes, wind damage, and other disasters that we've seen over the state of Minnesota, the rate of increase is not going down, it is going up. And so we think this is a reasonably prudent ask so that the legislature doesn't have to come back every time there is a disaster to have a special session to authorize funds for that. This disaster fund has made it fairly seamless for the local units of government to be able to access disaster relief rather rapidly.
Commissioner Representative Johnson has a question.
Chair Mariani, Commissioner, that $10 million in F year 21, is that $10 million per year for a total of $20 million or just $10 million for the biennium?
It's $10 million per year.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, sorry. Should I continue?
Hold on. Commissioner and members, and this is a question I was asking my staff. My understanding is that while certainly appropriate to share here because we have a good chunk of the public safety department in this committee, this particular account is not going to be decided through this committee. It will be decided in the committee that Representative Pawlowski leads. I can't remember the name of it. So let's just track that very carefully, make sure that we're coordinating. But I just want members to know that this $10 million would really be a request that doesn't, at least in my understanding, will not count against the target of this committee and will be decided by the committee that Representative Pawlowski leads.
The Greater Minnesota Economic Development Committee.
The Greater Economic that.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the clarification, and I do stand corrected on that. I think to germane to this committee is the reinstatement of the railroad and pipeline safety assessment. This will allow us to continue and ensure local preparedness for hazardous material incidents in communities along Minnesota's railroad and pipelines. We were fortunate that the recent train derailment up near Cloquet, which was a coal train that derailed, but because it is Minnesota at this time of the year, the ice is thick enough that even with a train derailment, the ice landed mostly on top of the ice and did not actually go into the waterways. There is some ice in the is some coal in the waterways, and I know that the Department of Natural Resources and the PCA are working right now to make sure that gets cleaned up. But this is preparatory money to try and be able to respond to those kind of incidents. And then finally, we also, under the emergency management group, staff the school safety center, which has seen its demands for additional technical assistance by local school districts grow up and up and up. The Parkland shooting, which we just recently had the anniversary of, is just one more reminder of what happens in our schools, unfortunately. And school districts are paying attention to that, and school districts are trying to make sure that they're well prepared for that most awful day that we all hope never happens. The school safety center has the technical assistance to try and help them prepare their buildings, prepare their staff, and then respond in an appropriate way if and when that day does come. So that is, we're looking for $250,000 in fiscal year 20 and $250,000 in fiscal year 21, and that would then be an ongoing appropriation as we increase the staff. The staff currently is, how many FTE, six? School
three.
Safety. Three, and I think this increases it up to
five.
So,
Commissioner, that was my confusion about this because I heard that they were short staff. So this is really about just getting back to the staff complement that existed prior and therefore not necessarily requiring new funding on top of base funding. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
All right, very well. Thank you.
Finally, we get to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and Director Drew Evans is here. The BCA is the state investigatory agency, and so it does investigative services from complex criminal investigations. I'm reminded of the double homicide and the officer-involved shooting up the other day up near Nevis. Violent crime task forces are staffed by them, both in terms of Fusion Center and also investigatory services. Narcotics investigations, predatory crimes are investigated. Forensic investigations, both digital and physical, financial crimes, information analysis. So it has a very broad mandate that it is meeting. And then one in particular area of it is the Forensic Science Service, which is, it is the primary state crime lab for most local units of government in the state of Minnesota. St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Hennepin County have their own crime labs. For everybody else, it's the BCA. So if you can imagine the amount of physical evidence that comes in that needs to be analyzed, and then the court reporting that has to go on with that also. BCA receives a direct appropriation of $59.9 million in fiscal 19. That was broken up between $2.4 from trunk highway funds and $57 million from the general fund. Currently, BCA has about 444 employees. We have several vacancies there. 82 are sworn special agents, and we have 97 bench scientists. The numbers, once again, much like the fireside, are pretty telling. 236 pounds of methamphetamine, another 19 pounds of cocaine, 40 grams of mushrooms, heroin, 1,700 prescription pills, 74 firearms. So the number goes on. 18,000 cases submitted to the lab for investigation analysis, 10,000 drug assignments that we had to make. 93 crime scenes responded to, and 422 court testimonies done. In 2019, We're looking to replace an automated fingerprint identification system, also affectionately known as AFIS. The system is our system that allows us to take fingerprints and have them scanned and then have them identified. The system we currently have is 12 years old. It is end of life. And our proposal is not to buy another system, but rather to lease the system, which is, once again, seems to be best practices. If you buy the system, you eventually, the system dies, you have to buy new patches. If you lease the system, the owner of the system continues to make the upgrades, and that keeps the system up to date and will also allow us to make sure that it's security compliant, because we don't want people's fingerprints being hacked or compromised there. So we have a security concern here and also just a functionality concern here.
Commissioner, I'm going to back us up a little bit. I apologize. I should have jumped in a little bit sooner about back when we were talking about the different crime labs. Representative Mueller had a question, so I want to make sure that...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's really not specific to the crime lab, just to say in my years as a prosecutor, I think the work the BCA does is just excellent. And I had an opportunity years ago to tour the BCA, and I was just wondering, I know that's not related to the budget, but it just came to me, and I was wondering if that's something that maybe the members would have an opportunity to do perhaps after session sometimes. I see the superintendent over there nodding his head, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
He's nodding his head, and I'm nodding my head, so yes, we're certainly welcome to come over to the east side of St. Paul where I live. and join us in a tour of the BCA. It's great space, frankly, and it does really amazing work. And one of the things I'm going to do as I'm learning greater Minnesota is I'm heading out to Bemidji. I'm going to go out to St. Cloud. I'm going to make sure I go out to some of their other field offices to try and make sure that do they have the facilities and the staffing that necessary so that they can meet the needs also.
Representative Mueller?
I'm good, thank you.
Yeah, Commissioner, I think the last time I visited the lab, it was on University Avenue.
Across from Whitaker Buick, as I recall, back in those days. So.
Neither of which are there.
No, that's true. So.
We do have a question for Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Commissioner, you're talking about leasing the new AFITS program. It's actually 12 years, should not be that old, it'd be obsolete. Those programs, for the cost we pay for them, should last much longer than that. Well, I'm just looking at the numbers quick, and I know leasing looks good up front. Sometimes at the back end, it really bites you. But just looking at the numbers, it's to buy a new program, it's estimated at $10 million. If we bought it or leased it for the 12 years, that's $18 million instead of $10 million. After 7 years, we're spending more than $10 million. If these programs aren't lasting that long, I think these computer designers need to go back to school and learn how to make something that works like they used to.
Commissioner, this is a good place, I think, to slow down. You and I had a bit of a conversation about this. And so let's just walk through that. It looks like you dialed a friend, perhaps.
I nodded, and suddenly, as if by magic, the superintendent of the BCA arrives, and he can bail me out here.
Please welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record. And you heard the question.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. It's a really excellent question when it comes to leasing. I will tell all the members of the committee, I too share probably some of the frustrations all of you do, but I would also say that any computers you have are probably not 12 years old sitting in front of you. It's a frustration that I think all of us have when it comes to computer technology. I will tell you the AFIS system at the state of Minnesota is one of the oldest systems in the entire United States. We're regularly talking about with the company that we currently utilize ways to make that system. We've been working over the last couple of years of ways to utilize that system more effectively, to get the most bang for our buck when it comes to that system, to ensure that we're doing everything we can internally to make that system last as long as we can. They have told us that we are at the end of the life of that system, that there's really very little they can do in terms of changing technology. We've bought additional servers. We've made additional changes to the actual hardware, the computer system itself. The system we have designed for this purpose was beyond a shelf life. What I will tell you in the challenge, because we ask the same question when analyzing these sorts of things in terms of leasing as opposed to paying for the system up front, is we are several iterations positions behind right now in our system because we are not getting those regular upgrades because we cannot pay for those as they come along. And so those upgrades will then be shifted to the responsibility of the company. That $10 million for one-time replacement would only last us a certain period of time, and that leasing cost is built in that. The other cost savings that we'll recognize in that process is the actual storage of the fingerprints will be shifted to a different methodology, and we'll be looking to cloud storage of the fingerprints, which we are able to do through various mechanisms with all the proper security in place. So some of that cost savings that we're paying for will be shifted to this particular way of doing the new system. I'll tell you, in terms of keeping up, we are currently in a partnership with North and South Dakota called MAFIN for this, which is the Midwest Automated Fingerprint Identification Network. South Dakota is in the process of evaluating leaving the network because we're so far behind in terms of the technology upgrades. We're also missing out because of the increased algorithms, or the better algorithms, I should say, associated with the upgraded systems. We will get better hits, solving more crimes in Minnesota, making additional identifications with an upgraded system.
So I hear part of that, because I had the same questions, Representative Johnson. Part of that is that the methodology and technology has evolved rather quickly. It sounds like better, and it also sounds like arguably we got a good bang for our buck for the investment over a decade ago.
Mr. Chair, members, I would agree with that, and the BCA constantly is making sure that we're using whatever resources we have internally to maximize the use of that system. And we did do a very careful analysis before making the request as to whether to choose pursuing a lease option as opposed, and we do believe it's in the best interest of the technology and Minnesotans in pursuing the lease option at this time.
Thank you. Commissioner, please proceed.
Thank you. The next item is also a technology piece, and that is the FBI cybersecurity compliance patch. This funding will address our cybersecurity vulnerabilities. We are currently out of compliance with the FBI's regulations on cybersecurity for our system. In order to bring ourselves into compliance, this will require $1.5 million in fiscal year 20, $1.3 million in 21, and then $1.2 million as an ongoing appropriation to maintain that link. It is important to note that for every local criminal justice and court jurisdiction that accesses federal criminal justice data, the BCA is, in fact, the hub that gets them the data. So we are in an essential link between being able to find out someone's criminal history in Nebraska or Miami when they commit a crime here in Minnesota, and also being able to coordinate our investigations with other state agencies both inside Minnesota and outside of Minnesota. Finally, there is the 2019 resources for our gun violence prevention work. This is a proposal to create new requirements for background checks when private parties transfer any firearm. This proposal creates an extreme risk protection order, and we recognize that this will require additional staff at BCA and to be able to do that. Our fiscal note so far shows that about $188,000 in fiscal year 20 and then $38,000 in fiscal year 21 and ongoing would be the fiscal note to support this initiative. Thanks. Yes. The last couple things, as I'm trying to get through these quickly, I know you're pressed for time. 2019 recommendations also are for us to add additional investigatory staff. So investigators, training coordinator, and analysts to provide statewide training on sexual assault investigations that we mentioned earlier. So this would also allow us to provide assistance to local partners and additional training. I was just meeting with the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and that was one of their concerns was can they get the specific training necessary so that their investigators can do the job they need to do on these kind of cases so that they can, in fact, keep up with the volume also. This is a $546,000 ask in 20, and then a $546,000 also in 21 and ongoing. In addition to the sexual assault investigations, there is also additional funding asked for investigators who would staff our work on vulnerable adult investigations. This could be financial crimes investigations, but it also could just simply be elder abuse investigations. And then finally, the last item on this list would be investigators, analysts, and forensic scientists to help us address the opioid abuse epidemic. What we have known is that as departments are working on prescription drugs, heroin, fentanyl, and all the rest of them, most of those cases come through the BCA, and in order for them to have a speedy trial, we need to be able to turn that drug analysis around. We are able to do it on a presumptive analysis, but the level of analysis necessary for actual prosecution takes now months to get, and we're backlogged on that. And so this would bring in enough forensic scientists so that we could catch up with our backlog, and then also bring in analysts that would allow task forces and other narcotics agents throughout the state to be more effective, and then allow our investigators also to supplement them on these complex multi-jurisdictional cases.
Commissioner, if I can back up to your prior PowerPoint slide, and this has to do with the two gun violence prevention proposals. And you and I chatted a little bit about this. It seems to me there's an argument in terms of just the capacity of your department to have good information, that these are good investments regardless of what the legislature may pass in terms of the two bills. I think there's at least two bills before us. Can you say a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I absolutely agree with you on that. In conversations I've had with local jurisdictions, they are struggling to keep up with the volume of folks that are applying through the traditional systems as they currently exist now. Adding new systems will simply increase the volume that they have to respond to. And then as part of this bill in particular, and I think this is a very prudent step, the question I often asked was, so you are qualified for a permit at one point in your life, and we are going to make the assumption that nothing else has happened since then that changes whether or not that decision to give you a permit still is valid. We all live lives. We all have things that have happened. And so the person who applied in good faith and was given a permit to purchase or permit to carry at a certain point in their life now has gone through a divorce, now has a young person in their house that may have a substance use problem, may have mental health problems of their own. And I don't think it's a safe assumption to say that once granted, it should be a lifetime. But in order to do the kind of checks that would give some level of certainty to those folks that are issuing those permits, you need to be able to run checks more regularly than not. And right now it's a one and done, and that doesn't seem to be a very prudent way of making sure that all Minnesotans are safe.
And Commissioner, it sounds then that you're hearing this directly from your locals.
This is absolutely a concern for local chiefs of police. I've had this conversation, and it's not universally. I will be perfectly straight up with you that it's not universally a concern or an area that all the locals are interested in pursuing. But there are certainly members of the Chiefs of Police Association, members of the Sheriff's Association who are very, very definitely concerned about gun violence in their communities and want to have better resources so that they can make the best decisions within the law.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani. Commissioner, on the, it's Mark's slide, I believe it's the next slide down at the bottom, and it talks about the funding new fees on opioid manufacturers and wholesalers, but you want $1.6 million in 20 and $1.242 million in 21. What would happen if the opioid stewardship fee was not enacted?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, if that stewardship was not enacted, I still believe that this is a prudent step forward in making sure that the issues around opioid abuse can be met. One of the concerns that, for example, that came up today from the local chiefs of police was whether outstate drug task forces who are working on this issue will continue to be funded at a level that allows them to keep doing what they're doing. They see this, they see the overdoses, they see the deaths, they see the destruction of families that the opioid epidemic is causing. They want to be responsive to that, but they also recognize that they have to live within their fiscal limits also.
Well, and so, Commissioner, somewhat similar to perhaps the prior question, what you're saying is, as a public safety professional, there's a need for this. The recommendation of the governor is that there's a need for it, and that we're identifying a source for that to pay for it. And that goes to your question, Representative Johnson, in terms of what happens to that source. But what I'm hearing you saying is that, you know, and obviously this will become a, you know, worst-case scenario, this will become a tough deliberation among us. But what I'm hearing you saying is that the need is not going to go away regardless of whether we find a new source.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. We're not seeing the need diminish. We're seeing the need continue to increase. And while there is a mechanism built into this, and I really do believe that the approach that we're taking, which is really a much more holistic approach, this is not a law enforcement-driven approach to reducing the opioid epidemic. This is really needs to be a health-driven approach. The opioid epidemic is really a health crisis as much as anything else. Law enforcement has a role. Policing has a role, whether it's in the lab, in education with our youth, or enforcement for those folks that are selling poison in the communities. So we have a role there. So the need is great. We are hopeful that there is a funding mechanism to fund all of the need. But whether it's funded or not, the need will continue, and local law enforcement, local sheriffs, and the local health community will all still have to respond to what happens when people that have an addiction to opioids are in their midst.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank the commissioner for that answer, but sitting here going through this, the PowerPoint, and as we go through, I've just realized this is my fourth time going through budget overviews. Generally, we have the budget books by now, just wondering when we're going to be able to have them so we can actually go line, as they're talking about this, actually study it and read it line by line.
Senator Johnson, I share that desire. It's been my practice as well over the years. A number of us chatted with the governor yesterday, and he promised us that those would be forthcoming as soon as possible. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I would point to MMB, but I don't have any control over that particular light item that you're referencing. But if there is specific questions that I can answer, I'm happy to do so. But I don't have an answer on the budget books per se.
I think it was more a procedural question and a practice question here. It certainly is helpful to have those books. I agree.
The chair and the staff put them together.
Yep, indeed. Very well. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the slide, actually, just before this one about the gun violence prevention. So if someone goes to their local sheriff's department, for example, and is seeking a permit to carry or permit to purchase, what is the interplay with the BCA? So the citizen just sees what the sheriff is doing and their actions, but can you explain to the committee what does the BCA actually do and why you need two additional staff members at the BCA to fulfill if these two laws are or bills are passed into law? What would the BCA be doing?
Mr. Chair, Mr. O'Neill, I've asked Superintendent Evans to come back and respond to that. From as a local LEO in the past, I can tell you that we would get the request. We would use the BCA's data to try and do the initial background assessment is what we would use the BCA. And it's quite simply a matter of volume at that point as to can we get our information in a timely fashion. So,
Members, let me just back up to Representative Johnson's query, because I misunderstood the process as well. My understanding is that the budget books are, in fact, already online and available. And I think the query you have really is toward, you know, to me as the chair, is to make sure that we print those out, because perhaps I'm sort of like you, you know, where I don't mind going online, but I prefer having something in front of me. And that's been my experience over the years. And so you certainly have the board, the chair's commitment that we'll make that happen as soon as possible. I'm sorry, Commissioner?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, really the amount isn't, the amount that we need there is to make changes to our database. So as local police chiefs and sheriffs are making their background checks and they're going through their process, this is changing our database as in our background check requirements through programming, essentially, is what we need and the capacity needed to do that. This is the impact regarding these bills, really, is this is a minimal impact to the Bureau in terms of what we need to do. The additional work would be primarily done by the police chiefs and sheriffs across the state. This reflects changes that we need to make to implement this policy in our databases at the BCA.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that background checks in general are very complicated. We've talked about that before, that you have an average of about 150 different types of background checks that you're trying to accomplish for different, all kinds of different agencies and reasons. So what do you need to upgrade in the system in order to accommodate this?
Maybe that would be helpful. Director Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's our gun permit tracking system, which is a system we developed in partnership with the sheriffs across Minnesota. The current law, as it interacts, it's just programming that needs to be done. The cost to us is relatively minimal. It's truly computer programmer time that will be done to implement the actual new language that would be in this law. The additional cost, though, is, as you can see in here, district courts have some additional costs in this as well, which may not be up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
$38,000 is the ongoing cost to our infrastructure at the BCA.
Thank you, Director. We have another question from Representative Glassell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Commissioner. You used divorce as an example of a new background check. How does that scenario play out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Glassell. What I was really more referring to was a case where there was a domestic violence episode in a family and where someone who's been convicted of a domestic violence is then prohibited from having a firearm. And so that change in that person's status would be something that would not necessarily be picked up from point A to point B. So divorce was a misstatement. Really what I was talking about was a serious felony domestic violence case that would change the person's ability to possess a firearm.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And
you're up, Sir Ross.
So it'd be the totality of circumstances or criminal history background and so on. One more, sir? Mr. Chair, one more?
Sir Ross.
And I guess, you know, since we're back on the gun violence protection, and I've heard my colleagues across the aisle say that the gun violence comes from even a deeper issues in society. And I've heard that more than once during committee times. So I guess, and yet the answer is just, the answer from what I'm seeing from the bills is to put the burden on law-abiding citizens as far as these checks and so on. Some of the legislation I have, it goes after the perpetrators. From what I've seen, these bills have the effect on the law-abiding citizen. And I guess, why are we throwing it on their shoulders?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair? Representative Grassel, possessing a firearm, while it is absolutely a constitutional right, bears with it a great deal of responsibility. Anyone who's ever carried a gun for a living recognizes the grave responsibility, because implicit in that is the idea that you may take another person's life. And clearly, there are other uses for firearms, hunting, and sports. But what we are obviously most concerned with in this is reducing the rate of gun violence that are perpetrated between individuals. And I think as we share the responsibility for safe roads. We share the responsibility for safety, I think, in this area also. And I think this simply makes it clear that all of our public safety is a shared community responsibility. It does not reside simply on those who violate the law, but we are all responsible to each other for making sure that we are safe.
Representative Grossell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's that line of thinking just throws me into kind of a what are we getting at? So that if we have that line of thinking that because I own a firearm, I could potentially take another person's life. If I own a computer, then I could potentially perpetrate on a child through child pornography. If I go downtown, I could potentially, you know, become a John and try to pick up a lady off the corner. You know, so should we be having background checks for a computer possession? Because as far as I'm concerned, the victimization of children is a heinous and violent crime. And through ICAC, that they're seeing the growth in that. So should we potentially be having legislation come forward for that type of crime as well? I mean, that's if we go about these things with that line of thinking, we should be having legislation for everything that could potentially be used to perpetrate a violent crime against a person.
Mr. Chair,
members, hold on just for a second. So this issue arose in the commissioner's laying out the request in order to help local jurisdictions with their requests for assistance in regards to meeting their duties relative to guns and gun violence in their community. But we can certainly have this conversation. I don't want to quell it. But I just want to get us back to the perspective here, number one. And number two, I also want to say we're trying to figure out, you know, how to get through the budget presentation. And so my proposal is we know that the sentencing guidelines has a very brief presentation. They tell us about 10 minutes they can get through it. It could be terrific. They're here if we can get through that. And Commissioner, you're almost done, I believe.
I have one more item, and it's non-fiscal, actually. So.
And that, of course, leaves the Pulse Board, but my thought is that we could finish the Pulse Board presentation on Wednesday. And so the idea is let's get you all home after we're done in session today. And so, Commissioner, I'll ask you for a very brief answer. My hope is that we don't get into a long philosophical conversation. There are important viewpoints all over the place on this, but I really want to get through the budget presentation as expeditiously as possible. I think we're going to have opportunities to have that philosophical conversation certainly next week.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Ross,
we made it past the gun violence section, but you brought us back here.
Fair enough.
Mr. Chair, with timeliness in mind, I will say that I think we do need to have that philosophical conversation. It is a longer conversation about where our joint communal responsibilities to each other lie, and so I will simply say that I stand by my position that I believe that we have a responsibility to take care of each other. And that this is will facilitate local law enforcement and the state being able to do a better job of doing that. But I welcome the conversation and the opportunity to continue the discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Russell. We have Representative Poston and then Long.
Mr. Chair, my question was asked and answered. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Representative Long. Very well. Commissioner, please.
My last slide is a BCA budget policy request, which, was, as I mentioned, has no fiscal impact. It is
will facilitate the BCA being able to do background checks for contractors at non-criminal justice agencies. This request, this policy change, is needed to meet the FBI's requirements to secure criminal justice information systems used in non-criminal justice agencies. And so these background checks would have an associated fee that covers both the amount charged by the FBI as well as the costs incurred by the BCA. And so there is no fiscal impact on this.
Very well. I believe with that, then we'll segue over to the Post Board budget request. I want to thank you gentlemen for your presentation and your engaging in our question and answer here today. Look forward to working with you on the budget in the coming weeks.
Chairman, thank you very much.
I'm sorry, did I miss? I misspoke. Sentencing guidelines. Thanks, John. Art?
Yeah, I do too.
Chair Mariani,
I did forget one question for the chief.
Oh, okay. Commissioner, budget. Can I just for a minute?
Side to side.
Commissioner, Representative Johnson does have one question. I wonder if you can indulge us for a few seconds.
Chair Mariani, Commissioner Harrington, I was just wondering the total number of, the total number over base on the budget this year.
Commissioner, the total number over base on the budget this year.
I do not have that number off the top of my head. It's so.
Okay, if you could provide that for us.
I will provide that to you shortly. Sorry.
Why don't we ask our fiscal staff? Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but it's about $11 or $12 million in general fund terms.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. I'm sorry. Yes. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Linda McBrayer, and I am the management analyst of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I am filling in today for our executive director, Nate Wrights, who was called out of the state on military leave yesterday and today. Thank you for inviting the agency to present the governor's budget request to you. The 11-member Sentencing Guidelines Commission employs 6 full-time staff members, our director, 2 senior research analysis specialists, 1 intermediate research analyst, 1 research analyst, and myself, a management analyst, 4. 3 of the 6 staff members have been employed by the commission for over 15 years, and 1 just hit the 30-year mark a couple of months ago. Consistent with the agency's history, in fiscal 2018 and 19, compensation of those 6 full-time employees will continue to be the single largest expenditure by category. As this chart shows, 90% of the agency's base budget is for compensation. With respect to the remaining 10%, and actually it would be 91.9%, the majority of the agency's operating expenses fund the rent of our office in the Centennial Office Building and minute and other technology requirements. The agency's staff's statutory duties may be said to fall into 1 of 2 focus areas. The first, shown on the left side of the slide, is ensuring the continued successful operation of Minnesota's sentencing guidelines. We support the commission with research and administrative support as it continually works to improve the guidelines, and we support practitioners around the state as they attempt to accurately implement the guidelines in over 18,000 felony cases annually, individually reviewing the sentencing worksheet in each of those cases. The second focus area on the right side of the slide is serving as a clearinghouse and information area for sentencing practices data. We provide a wide variety of reports on sentencing practices to policymakers, practitioners, and the general public, including assisting in the preparation of fiscal notes and demographic impact statements to the legislature. And effective August 1st of 2016, the legislature gave this agency a new requirement to collect and analyze information regarding the impact of changes to drug laws, including the Drug Sentencing Reform Act. The governor's request recommends funding the agency at $24,000 above base to maintain the current level of service delivery. No new staffing positions are being requested, and this operating increase is primarily driven by the compensation costs increases as anticipated by the governor. This chart shows the agency's staffing levels for the past decade. The green line shows the number of full-time employees per 10,000 felony cases sentenced annually. Case volume is a major driver of our day-to-day workload. That number has been at or below 4 employees per 10,000 cases sentenced since 2011. The blue line shows the number of full-time employees. The agency has had 6 or sometimes 5 full-time employees since 2010. Due to increasing compensation costs, it has been increasingly difficult in recent years to maintain the 6th employee on a permanent basis. But last year's addition of half of a research analyst position enabled us to do so once again. I would also like to point out that these increasing compensation costs are outside of this agency's control. The current configuration of the 6 employees is exactly the same as it was in 2012. No one has been promoted to a higher position since then. Mr. Chair, subject to your questions, that concludes the budget presentation for the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. McClure? If not, then anticipation, as Carly Simon would say. Thank you, Ms. McGraw. I look forward to working with you and your staff in the budget presentation, but we did tweak out a question here. Representative Dobson.
Chair Murray, I do not have a question. I have a comment.
Please.
I just want to thank her for coming here. I know how hard the Sentencing Guidelines Committee and their staff work, and I appreciate all the work they do.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, thank you. I will take that back to the staff.
Thank you, Ms. McGuire. Representative Pitlow.
Well, as long as Representative Johnson said that, I just want to say, too, that as my role as prosecutor, I've called the Sentencing Commission many times. I've actually talked with you directly, yeah. Ms. McBrayer, and, yeah, extremely helpful. And often there's some complications you have to kind of think through, and you all have been great. So, anyway, just as long as he did it, I figured I'd pile on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Chair Pinto, I'm seeing a few nodding heads of others who I think have interacted with the office as well. Very well. Then with that, members, Representative Johnson.
I just wanted to have the presentations done. It goes back to the discussion we had earlier in the beginning of the meeting. Because we are televised and people are seeing what's going on here, we've had a lot of people texting me. There's 2 middle schools in Edina, and they're wondering which middle school it's going to be at.
I'm told it's Valley View Middle School.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I realize that Chair Constantine must have stepped out, but I had let him know that, you know, I actually have been assigned to 2 committees that meet at the same time. So I'm on the Tax Committee, which meets Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 8 a.m., and then Corrections, that meets at Wednesday at 8 a.m. And so if we're going to have an additional meeting on Tuesday next week, I'm actually presenting a bill in taxes at the exact same time. So as lead for corrections, I'm not able to be there. It's hard enough for me to bounce back and forth between the two, which I have been able to do, except for obviously when we went to Stillwater, then I couldn't go at all to taxes. But I just wanted to get that on the record and say that that's it's a very, very challenging thing, and it's become impossible now with an additional meeting on Tuesday for me to be there.
Representative O'Neill, that's fair. That unfortunately, for all the years I've been here, quite frankly, has been a feature of our legislative process. It's obviously easier for all of us to manage it up front. In the beginning of session, it gets increasingly difficult as we near these deadlines, and chairs are trying to honor the requests for bill hearings. Sometimes we try hard, but those hearings don't go as quickly as we want them to go, but I think they go at the pace that needs to go in terms of the questions that we generate in the deliberations. And so I totally feel you. I've been there many times. I'm sure that Chair Considine understands, can't speak for him, but I think he understands the situation that this puts you in, as well as some others. I think he's probably been put in that situation as well a number of times. I certainly have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just point out the fact that I'm actually on two committees at the exact same time, which is really what the conflict is that I serve on taxes and serve on corrections that meet at the exact same time. So I'm not quite sure how that happened, but, well, I do know how it happened. It was that the committee moved at the last minute from a Monday to a Wednesday. But in any case, I've been trying to manage that, and I just wanted to let you know that that is a conflict for me because now we've added an additional Corrections Committee on Tuesday. Thank you, Chair.
And Representative O'Neill, I know that you, like many others here, certainly want to sit in the hearings to participate in the conversations and the learning, because we're constantly learning here. I'm told there will be no votes required at the corrections meeting. And when there are votes required, it lends to the anxiety of us trying to fulfill our duty to the public. But it's a small comfort, but at least that won't be happening at that corrections hearing that day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. With that, members, I trust you all have a terrific weekend as we continue to dig out the snow, and I'll see you all next week. This committee stands adjourned.